Maybe we should also conduct a brief survey of the blood that's been shed by atheists over the centuries. It might be surprising to see what we find. In fact, it might reveal a clue as to why atheists seem so content to remain in a state of oblivion. Chapter 3. The Ruthlessness of the Atheists. Have you ever heard of the big lie? It's an expression that was first coined by Adolf Hitler in his 1925 book, Mein Kampf, and it was used to describe the propaganda technique that he successfully employed to catapult the Nazi Party into power, and then to maintain control of the German people for more than a decade. It's based on the idea that while small lies are easily exposed, refuted, and rejected, big, blatant lies can often seem more credible if presented in the proper way. The reason is that good people have trouble believing anyone would even attempt to tell a lie that's enormous and obviously untrue. Therefore, if that lie is repeated often enough and with sufficient conviction, the people who hear it will actually begin to question their own powers of judgment and start to believe what they instinctively know to be untrue. It's a fascinating and evil concept, and it's worth listening to Hitler himself explain it. Quote, "In the big lie, there is always a certain force of credibility, because the broad masses of a nation are always more easily corrupted in the deeper strata of their emotional nature than consciously or voluntarily. And thus, in the primitive simplicity of their minds, they more readily fall victims to the big lie than the small lie, since they themselves often tell small lies in little matters, but would be ashamed to resort to large-scale falsehoods. It would never come into their heads to fabricate colossal untruths, and they would not believe that others would have the impudence to distort the truth so infamously. Even though the facts which prove this to be so may be brought clearly to their minds, they will still doubt and waver and will continue to think that there may be some other explanation. For the grossly impudent lie always leaves traces of believability behind it, a fact which is known to all expert liars in this world and to all who conspire together in the art of lying. These people know only too well how to use falsehood for the basest purposes." End quote. This technique of deception, though conceived by Hitler, was refined and put into practice on a massive scale by Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi minister of propaganda, who famously wrote, quote, "If you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. The lie can be maintained only for such time as the state can shield the people from the political, economic, and/or military consequences of the lie. It thus becomes vitally important for the state to use all of its powers to repress dissent, for the truth is the mortal enemy of the lie, and thus by extension, the truth is the greatest enemy of the state." End quote. Thus, according to the main architects of the big lie, this method of propaganda works best if the following three elements are in place. 1. A huge, colossal lie. 2. Constant repetition of the lie to a mass audience. 3. Suppression of the truth through a climate of fear. The most effective application of this technique, of course, took place in the 1930s against the Jewish people. Goebbels, making use of the mass media available at the time, including radio, movies, billboards, and high-speed printing and distribution of magazines and newspapers, told the lie that the Jews were subhuman, that they were evil incarnate, and that they were responsible for all the economic hardships being experienced by the German people. Obviously, this was absurd, but the Nazi propaganda machine, working in tandem with the mass media, went into full gear, repeating the lie in every possible way. They convinced the German people that Jews were poisoning society and were responsible for every evil imaginable, and that the only way humanity could be saved was to rid itself of Jewish influence. We all know what the final solution to this problem entailed. the extermination of the Jews and the Holocaust. It wasn't until the Allies crushed the Nazi army in 1945 and pictures of the concentration camps were shown to the German public that the big lie was finally exposed. But while the forces of good triumphed in World War II, the big lie technique didn't disappear with the Nazis. It was utilized many times in the 20th century with deadly results, and unfortunately, it is being used today in an effective manner by, you guessed it, our friends, the new atheists. How so? In the last chapter, we looked at the constant refrain that religion is responsible for more death, bloodshed, and war than any other single factor in history. That charge is shouted from the hilltops by atheists everywhere and then trumpeted by their sympathizers in the entertainment industry, the media, and the academic world. It's even familiar to school children who are taught very early about the Crusades and the Inquisition and many other so-called crimes against humanity perpetrated in the name of God. We'll have something to say about those infamous events shortly. But the first point to make clear is this. It's a lie. A big lie. A big, blatant, bold-faced lie. Religion is not the cause of most of the wars that have taken place. It is not the cause of most of the murders that have taken place. It is not the cause of most of the bloodshed that has taken place. To even suggest such a ridiculous thing is to display an ignorance of history tantamount to imbecility. The number one cause of war and bloodshed on this planet is, was, and always will be economic gain. One country or city or town wishes to take control of another's wealth and attempts to do so through force. Violent conflict ensues. People die. In ancient times, the economic benefit might have been gold or silver or precious jewels or land or tools or livestock or slaves. In modern times, the economic benefit usually takes the form of oil or technology or machinery or resources for manufacturing. No matter the specific object to be gained, the underlying motive is always the same. Money. Next to economics, and often connected with it, the most common cause of war and bloodshed in the world has been territorial gain. One country or city or town comes to the conclusion that it desperately needs more land, either for economic reasons, such as agriculture or oil, or because it wants more living space, such as the Nazi invasion of its neighboring countries, or the creation of buffer zones between enemies, such as in the Middle East or the Ukraine. These are the two main reasons for violent conflict in human history, and nothing else. And they are worldly in nature, not religious. Beyond these, the principal kinds of wars have been civil or revolutionary. Within a given country, internal disagreement arises as to how the nation should be governed. Passions are inflamed and war and carnage follow. Or perhaps a segment of the population revolts against its rulers for the purpose of changing the leadership or to gain self-determination. Civil and revolutionary wars account for a vast number of the bloody conflicts that have taken place on this planet, and almost all of them pertain to gaining political power. Very few have been about religion, faith, or God. In fact, even when the stated purpose of a war is ideological in nature, its underlying cause is usually civil, revolutionary, economic, or territorial. For example, France and England have gone to war countless times over the centuries. But do you really think for one second that the reason is that the English are Protestant and the French are Catholic? Likewise, even though there was much talk during the American Revolution about fighting for the noble cause of inalienable rights, is there any question that the main reason the colonists rebelled against Great Britain was to gain political and economic freedom? Even the Israeli-Palestinian conflict today cannot truly be said to be religious in nature. Yes, both parties make claims that God has given them a particular parcel of land. But the conflict is clearly a dispute over self-determination and the ownership of a specific geographical territory. The real rivalry, as any student of history or geopolitics knows, is ethnic rather than religious. The point is that it is preposterous to claim that religion has caused most of the wars in history, when even a cursory glance at history shows otherwise. According to Phillips and Axelrod's three-volume Encyclopedia of Wars, which chronicles some 1,763 wars that were waged between 8,000 BC and AD 2000, only 123 can be classified as religious in nature. This represents 6.98% of all wars that have ever taken place. If you subtract Islamic wars from the equation, the percentage falls to a tiny 3.23%. How on earth can atheists hysterically complain that Christians have caused so much bloodshed when they account for less than 4% of all of humanity's wars, while over 96% have been caused by other factors? Bear in mind, we haven't even talked yet about the number of war casualties. If you look at a list of all the violent conflicts that have taken place in history, from the Vietnam War to World War II, to the Chinese Civil War, to the Mexican Revolution, to the Napoleonic Wars, to the Mongol conquests, you'll see that the overwhelming majority of people killed were the victims of governments and not religions. Rudolf Rummel, the renowned professor of political science, who spent his entire career studying data on collective violence in war, coined the term democide to describe the all-pervading historical phenomenon of murder by government. According to Rummel, in the last 100 years alone, quote, almost 170 million men, women, and children have been shot, beaten, tortured, knifed, burned, starved, frozen, crushed, or worked to death, buried alive, drowned, hung, bombed, or killed in any other of the myriad ways governments have inflicted death on unarmed, helpless citizens and foreigners. The dead could conceivably be nearly 360 million people. It is as though our species has been devastated by a modern black plague. And indeed it has, but a plague of power, not germs. End quote. Ranked according to death toll, 3 of the 10 bloodiest wars of all time were waged in the 20th century. World War I, World War II, and the Second Sino-Japanese War. World War II alone, fought between 1939 and 1945, easily surpasses all other war death tolls, with upward of 70 million people killed. Do atheists really need to be reminded that World War II had nothing to do with religion? But it gets worse. The bloody figures we've mentioned only demonstrate the obvious fact that when it comes to war, worldly causes like economics and politics far outnumber religious ones. But what if we go deeper? What if we looked at atheist leaders and examined what happens when they are in power? What if we specifically looked at the wars and mass murders that have occurred during the reign of godless regimes and see how they compared to religious wars? And here we discover why atheists are always so content to remain oblivious to history. Here we see one of the main reasons for the big lie about war and religion. The truth is, atheist-based philosophies and leaders bear the blame for the vast majority of deaths caused by war and mass murder in the world. Just listen to this abbreviated list of some infamous non-religious dictatorships of the recent past. Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union, 42,672,000 killed. Mao Zedong of China, 37,828,000 killed. Adolf Hitler of Germany, 20,946,000 killed. Chiang Kai-shek of China, 10,214,000 killed. Vladimir Lenin of the Soviet Union, 4,017,000 killed. Hideki Tojo of Japan, 3,990,000 killed. Pol Pot of Cambodia, 2,397,000 killed. According to Stéphane Courtois in his book, The Black Book of Communism, atheist communist governments killed more than 100 million people in the 20th century alone. Ex-atheist Theodore Beale agrees, quote, "There have been 28 countries in world history that can be confirmed to have been ruled by regimes with avowed atheists at the helm, of whom more than half have engaged in democidal acts of the sort committed by Stalin and Mao. The total body count for the 90 years between 1917 and 2007 is approximately 148 million dead at the bloody hands of 52 atheists," end quote. Let's just examine two of these dictators. Joseph Stalin, who rose to power in the Soviet Union in 1927 and remained General Secretary of the Communist government until his death in 1953, tops everyone's list of all-time murderers. Stalin was, of course, an avowed atheist. As dictator, he promoted atheism through the education system, anti-religious propaganda, anti-religious discrimination laws, the creation of a League of Militant Atheists, and most importantly, a barbaric and bloody campaign of persecution against believers that he relentlessly pursued for 25 years. Under his atheist regime, all religions in the Soviet Union, including the Roman Catholic Church, Eastern Catholic Church, Islam, and Judaism, were violently oppressed. Monks were killed, nuns were raped, and hundreds of churches, synagogues, mosques, monasteries, and temples were desecrated and burned to the ground. Stalin didn't limit his persecution to believers. He killed everyone who posed a threat to his power. During his dictatorship, he prosecuted a reign of terror unmatched in the annals of history, with mass executions, purges, and exiles to gulag labor camps. He also methodically engineered famines on vast tracts of land in the Ukraine for the specific purpose of destroying the people there who sought independence from his rule. As a result, close to 7 million peasants died in this farming area, once known as the breadbasket of Europe. The total death toll under Stalin is difficult to estimate, but most historians put it between 40 and 60 million people. Now, let's look at Hitler. You'll sometimes hear atheists make the ludicrous claim that Hitler was a Christian, but that's just another lie. Hitler, as we've seen, was the inventor of the big lie and a master of propaganda. During his early rise to power, he pandered to Christians in the same way he pandered to anyone he thought could help him achieve his objectives. Basically, Hitler wanted to use religion to enable him to gain power, to subvert it for political reasons, and then to eliminate it after his Third Reich had been firmly established. Indeed, once Hitler became Chancellor of Germany, he began a brutal campaign of persecution of the church, imprisoning and killing large numbers of Catholic priests and bishops, as well as Protestant leaders. Anyone who persists in the ridiculous belief that Hitler was Christian has only to read some of his private conversations, first published in 1953 by Farrar, Straus, and Young. Here are some assorted quotes from the Führer. Quote, "The heaviest blow that ever struck humanity was the coming of Christianity. Bolshevism is Christianity's illegitimate child. Both are inventions of the Jew," end quote. Quote, "National socialism and religion cannot exist together," end quote. Quote, "The reason why the ancient world was so pure, light, and serene was that it knew nothing of the two great scourges, the pox and Christianity," end quote. Quote, "Christianity is an invention of sick brains," end quote. Quote, "Our epoch will certainly see the end of the disease of Christianity," end quote. As the Nuremberg documents clearly reveal, Adolf Hitler embraced the atheist tenets of fellow German Friedrich Nietzsche. It was the Nietzschean belief in the Superman, Übermensch, combined with a ruthless Darwinian view of social politics that led Hitler to think he could create a German master race. Simply put, he believed that large populations could be genetically improved by the use of selective breeding, which required the elimination of inferior races and blood strains in order to purify Germany's gene pool. Ultimately, this delusion led to the extermination of approximately 6 million Jews and 4 million people from other religions deemed inferior to the Nazis. When you add in all the other lives lost in World War II, the total figure comes to more than 20 million human beings killed as a direct result of this one atheist monster. The historical evidence is clear. In the long catalog of human atrocities, atheism has produced a body count second to none. This is neither speculation nor biased opinion. It is incontrovertible fact. But what about the Crusades, the atheists cry predictably? What about the Inquisition? Atheists have been whining about the Crusades and the Inquisition for 800 years. Let's talk about these two events for a second. The Crusades were a series of 9 wars that took place between the years 1095 and 1272. The objective of these wars was to reclaim the Holy Land, which had been captured by Muslim forces several hundred years before. During the sack of the city of Jerusalem, Muslim armies had destroyed 300 churches and monasteries and mercilessly persecuted the Christian population. In the decades that followed, many other lands in Europe and northern Africa fell to Islamic aggression. Finally, Pope Urban II called on Christians to act militarily. Basically, the Crusades were fought to take back something that Christians believe had been stolen from them. They were born out of the violent aggression of militant Islam and were essentially defensive in nature. Now, many wars in history have been defensive. When the United States declared war on terrorism in the early 2000s, it was responding to what it considered an unprovoked attack on the World Trade Center. The objective was not to seize Muslim lands, but rather to protect U.S. citizens and their property. You may disagree with American policy and its motives, but the war on terror cannot be dismissed as a simple act of aggression against poor and innocent foreigners. Any thinking person would concede that it was more complicated than that. The same thing can be said for the Crusades. Though atheists and anti-Christian historians love to condemn these wars as comprehensively evil, the truth is more complex. The Crusaders claimed to be fighting a war of self-defense against violent Muslim aggressors. They claimed to be fighting a just war. Nobody can be completely sure of a historical event's fine details, but considering the kind of Muslim aggression that still exists in the world today, why is that so hard to believe? The Spanish Inquisition is also more complicated than atheists portray it. 2 Catholic monarchs of the Renaissance, Ferdinand II and Isabella I, established the Inquisition as a court of law in order to identify and penalize a group of people known as conversos, Jews and Muslims who were pretending to be Christian for political and social gain, but were secretly practicing their real religions. Though it's undoubtedly true that many innocent people were persecuted and killed during the Inquisition, certain mitigating factors must be kept in mind. First, the Inquisition began in the year 1478, more than 500 years ago, when reliable records were not so easy to come by. Second, it was established as a state institution, not a religious one. Third, its severity has been greatly exaggerated by anti-religious bigots whose real agenda is to use it as a stick for Catholic bashing. According to Henry Kamen, author of The Spanish Inquisition, A Historical Revision, the common picture we have of the Inquisition as a quasi-Holocaust perpetrated by the Church is unquestionably a myth, and the typical image of the all-powerful, torture-mad clerics behind it is largely an invention of certain 19th-century fundamentalist Christian authors who wanted to discredit the papacy. The actual number of people charged with crimes by the Spanish Inquisition was between 100 and 150,000. The actual number of people sentenced to death was only about 3,000. Of these, none was executed by the Church, but only by the state. Moreover, these deaths took place over the course of 350 years. Some historians contend that an additional 100,000 died in prison due to malnutrition or illness, but there's no evidence for that. During the same period of time, the plague wiped out a third of Europe's population. There's just no way to accurately gauge the number of deaths caused by the Inquisition itself. Phony statistics abound. The same holds true for the loss of life during the Crusades. An accurate count of the death toll simply doesn't exist. The common guess brings the body count to around 1 million total casualties in 9 wars stretched out over a period of 177 years. These figures are tragic, to be sure, but they simply don't compare to the death tolls of the atheist regimes we just examined. Remember, atheist tyrants of the 20th century murdered more than 100 million innocent people. Yet atheists turn a blind eye to this recent and well-documented atrocity and instead persist in jabbering about events that took place eons ago under murky historical circumstances. It's no wonder they resort to big lies. The truth is just too damning for them to face. But there's a deeper and more troubling question here. Why is it that atheists have been responsible for so many murders in history? Why is it that whenever an atheist regime takes the reins of power, life suddenly becomes cheap? After all, atheists claim that their philosophy is humane because it centers on humanity and not some make-believe God. But if that's true, why have atheist dictators tried to destroy so much of humanity? The answer is something atheists don't want to hear. It's something they refuse to admit. And yet it's something so simple that even a child can understand. The solution to this murderous mystery is that, without God, there is no final ethical judge of anyone's actions. Without God, there is no ultimate authority, no judgment day, no moral accountability. Atheist governments have killed more human beings than any religion in history because atheists don't believe in a God who says that killing is wrong. They don't believe in a commandment against killing. They don't believe in a commandment against anything. Sure, atheists may think that certain crimes are reprehensible, but ultimately, their reasons are either emotional or practical in nature, not existential. In other words, they might believe it's wrong to commit a particular crime because they're personally repelled by it, or because they think society can't function properly in an environment of rampant criminal behavior, but not because the crime is wrong in and of itself, not because the crime is an act which is contrary to the very nature of God, who is goodness and truth and life. Therefore, if an atheist dictator happens to believe it's not morally problematic to slaughter tens of millions of people, and he has the power to do it, why shouldn't he? Beyond this, atheists don't believe in the infinite value of the human person. This is something we discussed briefly in the last chapter. Christians and Jews who are committed to their faith believe that human beings are created in the image and likeness of God. They believe that human beings have immortal souls. They believe that God loves each and every one of us, and that each one of us is therefore worth more than the entire created universe. Atheists don't subscribe to this proposition. In fact, they think it's preposterous. That's why they create ethical systems based on savage philosophies like social Darwinism or Nazi Aryanism, and never on the bedrock principle that all human life is sacred. They just don't accept that principle as true. Lacking this belief in the value and dignity of human life, atheist leaders are free to do whatever they want in order to seize power, maintain control, and restructure society according to whatever utopian vision of the future they happen to fancy. And that includes committing sadistic, merciless, cold-blooded acts of terror and treating human beings as worthless garbage. This might sound like a harsh judgment, but it's not. We've already seen how modern-day atheists are guilty of incredible arrogance, ignorance, and deception, especially when it comes to the blood-soaked legacy they've inherited. But we haven't even scratched the surface. We haven't yet described how atheists have attempted to implement the third element of the big lie propaganda technique. We haven't yet discussed how they've tried to suppress the truth about their ferocious philosophy through a climate of fear, intimidation, and intolerance. But stay tuned. The worst is yet to come. Chapter 4. The intolerance of the atheists. How many times have we heard atheists moan and wail about religious intolerance? Next to all the blood that's been shed in the name of God, this is surely their all-time favorite complaint. They love repeating ad nauseam the charge that people of one religion, usually Christians, harbor nothing but animosity and hatred toward people of other religions. Meanwhile, atheists, noble creatures that they are, sit back and shake their heads in despair, sadly contemplating the tragedy of hate in the world, while they proclaim a doctrine that is, they assure us, infinitely more humane, loving, reasonable, respectful, and above all, tolerant. Yes, intolerance is such an important buzzword to atheists today. Simply defined, intolerance is an unwillingness to accept or endure views, beliefs, or behavior that differ from one's own, and an unwillingness to grant equal freedom of expression to others whose views, beliefs, or behavior differ from one's own. Atheists claim to vehemently oppose any kind of intolerance, especially the loathsome brand practiced by men and women of faith. In rejecting a God-centered and dogmatic view of the universe, they embrace the philosophy of secular humanism, which considers reason, science, and social justice to be the highest ideals in life. Thus, atheists think that the hallmark of their own thinking is tolerance for other people and their varied points of view. After all, within a pluralistic society such as ours, there are bound to be many viewpoints that can be rationally arrived at. And in order for social justice to prevail, there must be tolerance and respect for everyone, right? But this is where things get a little confusing. Since the great majority of men and women has always believed in God, it should be obvious that religious faith must at least have some kind of rationale behind it. You might disagree with it, even passionately, but logic demands you at least admit this fact. On that basis alone, the testimony of vast populations of human beings spread across the globe and spanning all of time itself, one would presume atheists could muster just a little bit of tolerance, not to mention respect, for those who hold a religious point of view. And yet, when we do a quick survey of comments from well-known atheists, we see something quite astonishing. Instead of carefully reasoned arguments filled with common sense, wisdom, understanding, justice, and tolerance, we find the following. Quote, "Our writings and actions are sincere attempts to rid the world of one of its greatest evils, religion," end quote, Jerry Coyne. Quote, "If I could wave a magic wand and get rid of either rape or religion, I would not hesitate to get rid of religion," end quote. Sam Harris. Quote, "Some propositions are so dangerous that it may even be ethical to kill people for believing them," end quote. Sam Harris. Quote, "First of all, there are no great religions. They're all stupid and dangerous, and we should insult them," end quote. Bill Maher. Quote, "All faith claims are equally rotten, false, dishonest, corrupt, humorless, and dangerous," end quote, Christopher Hitchens. Quote, "I think religion should be treated with ridicule, hatred, and contempt, and I claim that right," end quote, Christopher Hitchens. Not much tolerance here, is there? Not much respect for other points of view. Not much of an attempt at understanding or analytical thinking. If religion is supposedly so intolerant, why don't we ever hear this kind of vitriol coming from the lips of the Pope, or the Archbishop of Canterbury, or the Ecumenical Patriarch of the Eastern Orthodox Church, or the top evangelical leaders in the United States, or the Chief Rabbi of Israel, or the Dalai Lama, or even most Muslim leaders? Why are atheists the ones using such sweeping generalizations and such fanatical language? What could possibly account for this stunning lapse in secular humanist principle, this angry, misinformed, brutally intolerant, and blatantly hypocritical attack on all forms of religion? Al Stefanelli, the Georgia State Director of the organization American Atheists, reveals the truth. Quote, "Sometimes intolerance becomes quite necessary. intolerance towards beliefs and doctrines that serve only to promote hatred, bigotry, and discrimination should be lauded, as should extremist points of view toward the eradication of these beliefs and doctrines. Many people of faith are sociopaths, and quite a good number of them are psychopaths, end quote. Ah, now it makes sense. Intolerance must be eliminated at all costs, unless, of course, it is the atheist's intolerance toward people of faith. Then intolerance is not only acceptable, but also necessary and praiseworthy, since it serves the higher purpose of improving the human condition. Moreover, believers are just psychopaths anyway. So who cares what they think or what we do to them? Put another way, atheists are tolerant, as long as you agree with them. If not, watch out. If you happen to come to a different conclusion than theirs about the existence of God, even if it agrees with what the bulk of humanity has always believed, you are nothing but a bigot and hate monger and therefore deserving of discrimination. We see this kind of praiseworthy intolerance on display in its most chilling and frightening form when atheists question the rights of parents to raise their own children in faith. For instance, Richard Dawkins asks, quote, "It's one thing to say people should be free to believe whatever they like, but should they be free to impose their beliefs on their children? Is there something to be said for society stepping in? What about bringing up children to believe manifest falsehoods?" End quote. Sam Harris agrees. Quote, "When we find reliable ways to make human beings more genuinely enraptured by the fact of our appearance in the cosmos, we will have no need for divisive religious myths. Only then will the practice of raising our children to believe that they are Christian, Jewish, Muslim, or Hindu be broadly recognized as the ludicrous obscenity that it is," end quote. Psychologist and professor Nicholas Humphrey chimes in, quote, "Children, I'll argue, have a human right not to have their minds crippled by exposure to other people's bad ideas, no matter who these other people are. We should no more allow parents to teach their children to believe, for example, in the literal truth of the Bible," end quote. And Giovanni Santostasi, a neuroscientist at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, asserts, quote, "Religion should remain a private endeavor for adults. An appropriate analogy of religion is that it's kind of like porn, which means it's not something one would expose a child to," end quote. So religion is like porn. It's a ludicrous obscenity, a manifest falsehood. It cripples children who must be protected from their parents by the state. So much for tolerance. Of course, some atheists, such as author Zoltan Istvan, take a more moderate position. Writing in the Huffington Post, he says, quote, "I join in calling for regulation that restricts religious indoctrination of children until they reach, let's say, 16 years of age. Once a kid hits their mid-teens, let them have at it if religion is something that interests them. 16-year-olds are enthusiastic, curious, and able to rationally start exploring their world, with or without the guidance of parents. But before that, they are too impressionable to repeatedly be subjected to ideas that are faith-based, unproven, and historically wrought with danger. Forcing religion onto minors is essentially a form of child abuse, which scars their ability to reason and also limits their ability to consider the world in an unbiased manner," end quote. How considerate of Mr. Istvan. How magnanimous and generous to grant parents the legal right to expose their children to the religious point of view once they are past the point of impressionability. Believers should count themselves fortunate to have such a fair and thoughtful advocate. No, I'm afraid the truth is clear. According to atheists, religious faith is much too dangerous to be taught to children, despite the fact that it has sustained humanity from time immemorial and given rise to art, literature, music, philosophy, education, science, and humanitarian aid, it is really just a form of child abuse. Now, some atheists today do think their fellow non-believers have gone a bit too far. But these sensible atheists are difficult to find. In fact, If you search the web, you'll see hundreds of atheist-run sites under headings such as Christians are disgusting, all religion is evil, is there such a thing as an intelligent believer, and religion must be destroyed. Look for yourself. It is a veritable online orgy of rage. Yet, amid the ocean of venom, amid the calls for religion to be mocked, outlawed, and banned, there are a few quiet voices of sanity that seem to represent a less militant form of atheism. These folks disavow the anti-Christian, anti-Muslim, and anti-Semitic rhetoric of firebrands like Dawkins, Harris, and Hitchens, and they try to give credit to religion for the contribution it has made to the history of humankind on this planet. Though their efforts are greatly appreciated by people of faith, the truth is, these kinder, gentler atheists are actually very naive. They don't understand the raison d'être of their own movement. They haven't thought through the atheist position to its logical conclusion. In their desire to be amiable, they've neglected to be accurate. In fact, they've missed the historical picture completely. If they truly realized how out of touch they were with their own long tradition of intolerant hostility and violence, they would never be so foolish to think that they could change the boorish ways of their atheist brethren. That's just not going to happen. You see, the climate of anger and fear that atheists have created today through their vicious and despicable attacks on religion is nothing new. It's been their modus operandi for hundreds and even thousands of years. It was present at the very birth of Christianity. Remember that Jesus of Nazareth, a humble Jewish carpenter who never once held a weapon in his hands, didn't die a natural death. He was brutally executed. He was a victim of his pagan state's intolerance toward his statements of faith. Yes, the paganism of Christ's time was not exactly the same thing as the atheism of modern times, but they resemble each other much more closely than atheists would have us believe. The deities or gods of the ancient pagans were not at all like the god of Judaism or Christianity. They were purely mythological in nature, part of a storytelling tradition rather than a serious belief system. They were poetical rather than theological. Indeed, the pagans of Christ's time were morally ambivalent and decadent, just like the atheists today. They had no belief in a personal god who created the universe, just like the atheists today. They were pantheistic and nature-worshipping, just like the atheists today. Most important, their intolerance toward religions, especially Christianity, was of the same ferocious kind as that of atheists today. The true ancestors of the Christian-bashing atheists of modern times are none other than the Christian-bashing pagans of antiquity. To understand the bewildering hostility atheists display toward religions today, we must view it through the lens of history, starting with the first Christians who were persecuted so savagely at the hands of the Roman state. For hundreds of years after Jesus of Nazareth died, Christian practices were banned, Christian clergy were imprisoned, and tens of thousands of Christian families were mercilessly murdered in arenas like the Colosseum. Writing in the year AD 64, the Roman historian Tacitus described how the pagan Roman government treated the first Christians. Quote, "Nero falsely accused and executed with the most exquisite punishments those people called Christians, who were infamous for their abominations. The originator of the name, Christ, was executed as a criminal by the procurator Pontius Pilate during the reign of Tiberius. And though repressed, this destructive superstition erupted again, not only through Judea, which was the origin of this evil, but also through the city of Rome. Therefore, first those were seized who admitted their faith, and then, using the information they provided, a vast multitude were convicted for hatred of the human race. And perishing, they were additionally made into sports. They were killed by dogs by having the hides of beasts attached to them, or they were nailed to crosses or set aflame, and when the daylight passed away, they were used as nighttime lamps. Even though they were clearly guilty, people began to pity these sufferers." End quote. Though the writer of this account was sympathetic to the suffering of the Christians, his language demonstrates that he, being a pagan himself, clearly believed Christians were evil and guilty of abominations, including hatred of mankind. Indeed, it's eerie how little the tone of anti-Christian rhetoric has changed in 2,000 years. G.K. Chesterton put it best. Describing those first Christian martyrs, those poor men, women, children, and infants, all huddled together in the arena, quietly and courageously waiting for the ravenous lions to be released, he said, quote, "There shone on them in that dark hour a light that has never been darkened, a white fire clinging to that group like an unearthly phosphorescence, blazing its track through the twilights of history, a lightning by which its own enemies have made it more illustrious, and its own critics have made it more inexplicable. The halo of hatred around the Church of God," end quote. The halo of hatred. That describes it perfectly. A raging, intolerant, and inexplicable hatred directed toward people of faith everywhere. A hatred that is always completely out of proportion to their supposed crimes. This hatred seemed to fade somewhat during those centuries when religious belief was more fervent, and when religions themselves held more power in the state. But it never truly disappeared. It was only hiding, waiting for a chance to rear its menacing head again the moment atheists began to acquire real political power. And acquire power they did. During the French Revolution, anti-religious crusaders such as Jacques Hébert and Jacques-Claude Bernard sought to begin a new persecution of religion as they attempted to completely de-Christianize France and establish a government whose official ideology was the cult of reason. To accomplish this goal, French radicals encouraged the destruction and desecration of churches and cathedrals for the purpose of transforming them into temples of reason. The so-called Reign of Terror, which began in 1793, was marked by mass executions of enemies of the revolution, including Christians. The Catholic Church had opposed the revolution, which had sought to turn the clergy into employees of the state and required them to take an oath of loyalty to the new French government. This new government, atheistic in the extreme, persecuted and executed thousands of believers. The death toll is estimated at 40,000, with 16,000 killed by guillotine, and another 25,000 in summary executions across France. As many as 300,000 French men and women were arrested during a 10-month period between September 1793 and July 1794. Besides the guillotine, the atheist leaders of the French Revolution utilized other methods of execution, including the notorious practice of republican marriages, which involved stripping couples naked, tying them together to a log, and then drowning them. It's important to understand that the perpetrators of these heinous crimes were not unintelligent street rabble. They were journalists. They were politicians. They were educated ideologues whose thinking was characterized by a philosophy of militant atheism. This same philosophy was espoused by men like Auguste Comte, Ludwig Feuerbach, Karl Marx, and Friedrich Nietzsche. Not only did these atheists publicly denounce belief in God, but they also shared a white-hot hatred of religion and argued forcefully that it was humanity's solemn duty to destroy religious conviction altogether. To oppose this destruction, they claimed, was an act contrary to reason and historical progress. Tolerance was not part of their vocabulary. It was these atheist philosophers of the 19th century who laid the ideological foundation for the atheist political leaders of the 20th century. Their intolerance for religion and religious principles set the stage for the bloodiest wars and mass murders ever to take place on the stage of human history. Remember what we discussed in the last chapter. Atheist regimes of the 20th century, which included the Soviet Union under Lenin and Stalin, China under Mao Zedong, Albania under Enver Hoxha, and Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, ruthlessly murdered more than 100 million people. 100 million! Don't pass over that figure quickly. Listen to it. Think about it. Mull it over. 100 million people wiped out. All forms of religion brutally suppressed, churches and synagogues desecrated and destroyed, all by militant atheists. What was the reason for this carnage? The Christians and Jews who were slaughtered didn't commit any crimes. They weren't plotting revolutions. They weren't trying to amass political power. They weren't attempting to overthrow dictators. Their only offense was practicing their religion. They believed their first allegiance belonged to God, not the state. That was why the atheists who controlled the state butchered them. Indeed, that's what always happens when atheists control the state. Whether it was the decadent emperors of pagan Rome, or the French followers of the Cult of Reason, or the godless dictators of the 20th century, militant atheists showed their tolerance for people with other points of view by murdering them. And that's why any effort to promote a tolerant atheism today is futile. Tolerance is part of the big lie. It doesn't exist. The atheist statements we cited earlier about the obligations of the state to restrict the rights of parents to raise their own children are the tip of the iceberg. As atheists gain more political power and exercise more control over media, academia, and the entertainment industry, their attacks on religious freedom always grow more blatant and egregious. It's just part of who they are. Indeed, a modern-day persecution of religion by atheists has already begun, and the evidence is all around us. For the last 50 years in America, religious symbols, imagery, and sentiment have been systematically purged from the public square. Any kind of prayer, even non-denominational and silent prayer, have been forbidden in public schools. Quotations from Scripture, even the Ten Commandments, have been removed from courts and federal buildings. Government employees are no longer permitted to express themselves by hanging religious signs in their workspaces, but they are completely free to hang any other kind of non-work-related secular signs. Postage stamps commemorating religious holidays and holy people are hardly ever issued, while there seems to be no end to the number of commemorative stamps featuring secular celebrities like Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Elvis, Wilt Chamberlain, and Batman. School children no longer have Christmas and Easter vacations, but rather winter and spring breaks. During the holiday season, religious images like crèches and menorahs have been eradicated from most public places, and those attempting to retain them can be sued by organizations like the ACLU and the FFRF, the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Even reference to the word Christmas has been increasingly censored by advertisers, retailers, schools, and government offices. And while some secular aspects of Christmas, such as lighted decorations, have been retained to spur retail spending, they're usually showcased only on the condition that they be associated with an unspecified holiday season rather than the birth of Christ. At the same time that this purge has taken place, atheists have mounted a relentless public relations campaign to mock the Christian faith, especially during Christmas and Easter seasons. Billboards paid for by groups such as the American Atheists have appeared all over the United States, including the Bible Belt, with confrontational slogans such as, "Who needs Christ during Christmas? Nobody." And "Christianity, sadistic God, useless savior." And "Grow up, you're too old for fairy tales." And "You know it's a myth. This season, celebrate reason." Such in-your-face advertising is obviously calculated to provoke anger and to ridicule people's deepest beliefs at the holiest times of year. If multiculturalism is such a sacred value of secular society, where are all the calls for sensitivity to Christian culture? Just imagine if similar billboards were posted against other religious faiths, ethnic minorities, or even popular secular beliefs. They would be declared hate crimes, wouldn't they? And yet, in 21st century secular America, attacks on Christian beliefs go unchallenged. How could this be? A recent Rasmussen poll reported that 76% of Americans still believe that religious symbols should be allowed on public land. And 83% believe that public schools should celebrate religious holidays in some way. If this is the case, how could America allow itself to become a nation where all religious prayers, pageants, and holy days have been suppressed, while anti-religious bigotry is not only tolerated, but accepted as normal? The simple reason is that many Americans have been taken in by the big lie. They've been hoodwinked into accepting that religion is somehow dangerous to the Republic, and that there must be an impenetrable wall erected between it and the government. If people dare to challenge this nonsense, they're shouted down and intimidated by a loud, rude, and unrelenting chorus of hisses from a hostile atheist minority. The truth is, the Constitution of the United States says nothing about a wall of separation between church and state. When the First Amendment was ratified in 1791, it contained the Establishment Clause, which prohibited the government from establishing any state religion. But there's a huge difference between establishing a state religion and totally excluding religion from the state. The framers of our Constitution didn't want the federal government to set up some form of church or interfere with the free exercise of religion. That was their purpose, and nothing more. The idea that the placement of Christian, Jewish, or Muslim religious symbols on public property is somehow a violation of the Establishment Clause is ludicrous, and the founders of this country would have considered it an obscene distortion of their intent. Indeed, Thomas Jefferson once said, quote, "The legitimate powers of government extend to such acts only as are injurious to others. But it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god." End quote. For the last 50 years, unelected secular judges in this country have routinely abused their powers with impunity. Not only have they restricted the religious activities of the government, but they've also restricted the free religious expression of the people. In his book, Men in Black, How the Supreme Court is Destroying America, radio host Mark Levin states, quote, "The intensive and concerted effort to exclude references to religion or God from public places is an attack on our founding principles. It's an attempt to bolster a growing reliance on the government, especially the judiciary, as the source of our rights. But if our rights are not unalienable, if they don't come from a source higher than ourselves, then they're malleable at the will of the state. This is a prescription for tyranny." End quote. Tyranny. That is exactly what the militant atheist minority is always seeking to impose. No one with any common sense really minds when people say Merry Christmas in a post office or a government building. No one really feels discriminated against when they see a Christmas tree or a manger scene or a menorah in a public square. There needs to be a state of tyranny in place for such simple expressions of piety to be suppressed. And that's just the kind of state we're living in today. It's time to face facts. Atheists have nothing less than a totalitarian intolerance for believers. They are determined to root out and remove any remaining vestiges of Christianity from Europe and America, and even to deny parents the right to raise their own children with religious faith. They use the same language and harbor the same ambition as the communist regimes of the 20th century, though they've stopped short of employing physical violence to establish their vision of a godless utopia, give them time. They've instead driven their opponents from the public square with a lethal mixture of scorn, smears, deception, and legal intimidation. But why? What could possibly account for all this fury? What lies at the bottom of this black and fiery hatred of religion? Before we can answer that question, we need to lay a bit more groundwork. We need to enter into the atheist consciousness and actually try to understand the atheist mind. When we do that, we discover two striking qualities that have the potential to shed light on the deeper, more sinister mystery of the atheist's raging intolerance. These two character traits, next on our list to discuss, are a profound moral cowardice and an astonishing lack of intelligence. Chapter 5. The Shallowness of the Atheists. We said at the beginning of this book that the most prominent character trait of modern atheists is arrogance, followed closely by ignorance. Indeed, these two qualities seem to be racing against each other, with arrogance always managing to win in a photo finish. If, however, we ask the question, which atheist character trait deserved the longest discussion, there would be no contest at all. For while any chapter in this book might serve as the basis for a book of its